This episode is about a tension that medicine never really escapes. When should clinicians follow established practice, and when should they depart from it? That question sounds abstract until you put it next to two histories. In one, a physician notices that women are dying after childbirth at very different rates in two wards of the same hospital. He infers that doctors and medical students are carrying something dangerous on their hands from autopsy rooms into delivery rooms. He imposes hand washing with chlorinated lime, and mortality falls dramatically. But the medical establishment resists him. In the other history, surgeons encounter a new technique for removing the gallbladder. Laparoscopic cholecystectomy feels intuitively better than open surgery. Smaller incisions, less pain, shorter stays, faster recovery. It spreads with extraordinary speed and becomes the new standard before the evidence base has really caught up. These are opposite failure modes. In the Semmelweis story, medicine was too slow to accept a life-saving innovation because the idea offended prevailing theory, professional identity, and daily workflow. In the laparoscopic cholecystectomy story, medicine was too quick to accept an innovation because the idea was compelling, technically exciting, marketable, and aligned with what patients and surgeons wanted to believe. The point is not that guidelines are good and innovation is bad. It is also not that innovators are always right and institutions are always cowardly. The point is harder. Medicine needs both disciplined skepticism and disciplined openness. Either virtue, overdone, becomes dangerous. This matters directly for LLMs in clinical care. If an LLM recommends treatment, should it mostly reproduce guidelines? If it judges a doctor's treatment recommendation, should it score the doctor against established practice? What happens when the doctor is appropriately innovating, or appropriately individualizing, or appropriately resisting an overhyped new practice? And what happens when the doctor is simply wrong, but wrong in a way that local culture has normalized? The two papers in the Guidelines and Innovation folder make a useful pair for this problem. The first is Pioneering Hand Hygiene, Ignaz Semmelweis, and the Fight Against Puerperal Fever, a 2024 Curious article by Shelley Paul, Shraddha Salunkhe, Casaretti Cervanti, and Shaila Jaman. It is a historical review of Semmelweis, puerperal fever, hand hygiene, resistance, and legacy. The second is Delayed Assessment and Eager Adoption of Laparoscopic Cholecystectomy, Implications for Developing Surgical Technologies, a 2010 World Journal of Gastroenterology article by Alexander Allori, I. Michael Lightman, and Elizabeth Heitman. It is a critical appraisal of how laparoscopic cholecystectomy moved into standard surgical practice, and what that history teaches about technology assessment. Together, they form a warning label for clinical AI. If an LLM is merely an engine for enforcing consensus, it may punish the next Semmelweis. If it is merely an engine for amplifying novelty, it may help create the next wave of premature adoption. So the real question is, can we design clinical AI that understands the difference between deviation, innovation, uncertainty, and error? The Semmelweis paper begins with a familiar hero story, but the details are still worth slowing down for. Ignaz Semmelweis was a Hungarian physician working in obstetrics in Vienna in the mid-19th century. Puerperal fever, also called childbed fever, was a terrifying cause of maternal death after childbirth or abortion. The paper describes it as an infection of the genital tract that could progress to peritonitis, septicemia, pyemia, and death. Symptoms included fever, abdominal pain, and signs of sepsis. The historical irony is that hospital medicine, which should have made childbirth safer, often made it more dangerous. Lying in hospitals, operative obstetrics, repeated internal examinations, overcrowding, unsterilized tools, soiled fabrics, and poor knowledge of asepsis all created conditions for transmission. The paper notes that in some hospitals, puerperal fever mortality could be as high as 30%, and that at times it was considered safer to deliver at home than in a hospital. Semmelweis was appointed assistant at the first obstetrical clinic of the Vienna General Hospital in 1846. The hospital had two obstetrical clinics. The first was staffed by physicians and medical students. The second was staffed by midwives. Between 1840 and 1846, the paper reports a maternal mortality rate of 98.4 per 1,000 births in the first clinic, compared with 36.2 per 1,000 births in the second clinic. The table included in the article makes the disparity vivid. Across the years 1841 to 1846, the first clinic averaged a mortality rate of 9.92%, while the second clinic averaged 3.38%. In 1842, the first clinic's mortality was 15.8%, compared with 7.5% in the second. In 1846, it was 11.4% in the first and 2.7% in the second. this was not a subtle signal. Patients themselves noticed. Women reportedly feared the first clinic. Semmelweis searched for an explanation. The paper emphasizes that one key clue came from the death of his friend Jakob Kolechka, a professor of forensic medicine, who accidentally cut himself during an autopsy and died of sepsis. Semmelweis connected Kolechka's illness to puerperal fever. He reasoned that medical students and physicians were moving from autopsies to deliveries without adequate hand cleaning, carrying what he called cadaverous particles. He did not have germ theory as later medicine would understand it. He lacked the mechanistic vocabulary that Pasteur and Lister would later help provide. But he had a powerful observational inference. Something from the dissecting room was being transmitted by doctors' hands to women in labor. Semmelweis ordered medical personnel in the first clinic to wash their hands with chlorinated lime solution before examining patients. The paper reports a striking change. The first clinic mortality rate was 18.27% in 1847 and fell to 1.27% in 1848. That is the kind of result that feels, from our current vantage point, almost impossible to ignore. But it was ignored, resisted, and delayed. The article's discussion of resistance matters as much as the mortality numbers. Semmelweis's claim implicated physicians themselves as vectors of harm. It did not simply ask them to change a technique. It asked them to accept that their ordinary professional behavior could be killing patients. The theory was also not ready. Without an accepted germ theory, the intervention looked bizarre to many contemporaries. If disease was understood through older frameworks, invisible transferable particles on a doctor's hand seemed implausible. The paper also notes political and cultural context. Semmelweis was a Hungarian physician in Vienna during a period of nationalist tensions. His own communication style did not help. He was abrasive, delayed comprehensive publication, and often relied on directive hospital protocols rather than persuasive scholarly dissemination. The result was tragic. Semmelweis was dismissed from Vienna, continued the work in Hungary, struggled to win broad acceptance, and died in 1865, before his ideas were properly recognized. Later, Pasteur's germ theory and Lister's antiseptic surgery helped give a theoretical foundation to what Semmelweis had observed. For our purposes, the key lesson is not simply doctors should wash their hands. The deeper lesson is that evidence can arrive before the profession has a theory, vocabulary, institution, or emotional readiness for it. Semmelweis was asking medicine to update from outcomes. He did not have the whole causal model, but he had a sharp natural experiment. Same hospital, two wards, different personnel practices, dramatically different maternal mortality, and a dramatic improvement after chlorinated lime handwashing. Established practice failed because it treated theory and status as more authoritative than empirical signal. That is the first warning for LLMs. If a system judges doctors only by whether they followed currently codified practice, it may systematically undervalue careful observation, local evidence, and early corrective insight. It may penalize the clinician who says, the current standard is harming this group of patients, and here is the evidence. But that warning is only half the story. The laparoscopic cholecystectomy paper tells almost the opposite story. Open cholecystectomy, the traditional operation for gallbladder disease, had been described in 1882 and remained the standard for more than a century. Laparoscopic cholecystectomy, or LC, emerged in the 1980s. The paper traces development in France in 1985, popularization in 1987, and then rapid diffusion. The attraction was obvious. Remove the gallbladder through small incisions using laparoscopic instruments. Reduce postoperative morbidity. Reduce pain. Shorten hospital stay. Improve cosmesis. Possibly reduce cost. To surgeons and patients, the logic seemed merely self-evident. Less invasive should mean better. And LC did prove valuable over time. The authors are not arguing that LC was a bad operation. Their argument is more subtle and more uncomfortable. Even if LC ultimately deserved a major role, the early adoption process was not adequately evidence-based. The speed was astonishing. The paper reports that in the United States, LC accounted for 90% of all cholecystectomies only 4 years after its introduction. By the mid-1990s, it had become the standard of care for surgical treatment of gallbladder disease. The evidence base did not mature at the same speed. Allori, Leitman, and Heitman review the published literature and frame it through stages of medical innovation. Promising reports from 1985 to 1992. Professional and organizational adoption from 1993 to 1995. And later observational reports and standardization from 1996 to 1999. Their literature counts are revealing. From 1985 to 1999, a Medline search found 2,822 articles on LC. But there were no publications before 1990, even though the operation had been introduced years earlier and popularized globally before the literature really appeared. Between 1990 and 1993, 228 articles were published. Many focused on technique, safety, and instrumentation. But only 4 articles, or 1.8%, evaluated economic aspects or made an economic comparison with open cholecystectomy. Only 2 articles described practice trends, and only 8 discussed standardization of technique. Between 1993 and 1995, when LC was already becoming standard, 1,370 articles were published. Many concerned safety or variations in method and instrumentation. Outcome-oriented papers were often case reports. Only 46 articles, about 3%, discussed trends in utilization or standard practice. 43 focused on economics. Between 1996 and 1999, another 1,224 articles appeared. A large share still focused on safety, adverse reactions, and contraindications. The authors interpret this as evidence that safety questions had not been satisfactorily addressed early in the technology assessment process. The author's critical appraisal identifies several problems. First, study design. Much of the early literature consisted of anecdotal evidence and retrospective case series. As LC spread, open cholecystectomy was performed less often, which made rigorous contemporaneous comparisons harder. Once surgeons and patients lost equipoise, randomized trials became harder ethically and practically. That is a crucial adoption dynamic. If a technology spreads before the comparative evidence is gathered, it can destroy the very conditions needed to gather that evidence. Second, comparative controls. Many LC studies invoked historical open surgery outcomes without solid control groups. The paper highlights a 1992 longitudinal evaluation of open cholecystectomy by Clavian and colleagues, designed to serve as a historical control for future LC evaluations. But by 1999, it had been cited only 41 times, and fewer than half of those citations were in work addressing LC. Third, confounding. Some advantages attributed to LC may have reflected broader changes in postoperative management rather than laparoscopy itself. Shorter hospital stays, for example, might have resulted partly from abandoning unnecessary drains, avoiding routine postoperative antibiotics, and changing discharge practices. LC may have catalyzed those changes, but the question of how much credit belonged to the surgical technique itself was not fully answered. Fourth, scope. The literature often focused narrowly on morbidity, mortality, and length of stay, while underdeveloping cost analysis and patient-reported outcomes. The authors note that early economic studies were often rudimentary, and that only 2 robust economic analyses were performed during the period of adoption. Both were favorable to LC, but they appeared in economics journals and were not well absorbed by surgical audiences. Fifth, patient preference. The paper is skeptical of simplistic claims that patients preferred LC. One cited investigator found that surgeon enthusiasm itself could shape patient preference, and that a more thorough, informed consent process could eliminate the preference. Many studies reduced patient-reported outcomes to yes or no questions like whether patients were glad they had the procedure, rather than measuring quality of life rigorously. Sixth, consensus. The NIH held a consensus conference in 1992 and concluded that LC was safe and effective, with broad preference over open cholecystectomy, except in certain contraindications. But the paper argues that this consensus did not critically appraise the underlying clinical studies with enough rigor. A critic at the time observed that many references were not scientifically substantial, and that the literature still consisted largely of anecdotes, limited comparative study, little long-term follow-up, and few objective outcome measures from independent observers. The most interesting part of the paper may be its discussion of why this happened. LC was not mainly developed and popularized through academic centers. Private clinics and market forces played a large role. Surgeons had obvious incentives to offer the new procedure. Patients wanted less invasive surgery. Hospitals could market modernity. The idea that smaller incisions would lead to faster recovery seemed so intuitive that many people treated it as obvious before it was proven. The paper quotes a striking criticism from O'Brien, who worried that surgeons were testing the limits of laparoscopic possibility with too much enthusiasm, making trivial procedures difficult and difficult procedures even more difficult. That criticism was not enough to slow the revolution. The authors then connect LC to newer minimally invasive technologies, such as natural orifice transluminal endoscopic surgery, or NOTES. As of their search in 2009, they found that the notes literature was dominated by animal models, non-systematic reviews, and editorials or commentaries. Only a small number of human case reports and case series existed. Yet training seminars were already appearing, and the appeal of surgery without scars was strong. Their conclusion is a plea for disciplined technology assessment. Early safety studies should be followed by comparative outcome studies and economic analyses. Critical appraisal should occur periodically, and evidence-based medicine applies to surgery as much as to drugs. This is the second warning for LLMs. If a system is overly impressed by intuitive plausibility, professional enthusiasm, early case series, and patient demand, it may amplify premature adoption. It may mistake everyone is doing it, for the evidence is adequate. Putting these two papers together gives a balanced account of medical conservatism and medical enthusiasm. Semmelweis shows that established practice can be morally and scientifically wrong. It can persist because doctors are invested in existing theory, because the proposed change is humiliating, because institutions move slowly, because the innovator communicates poorly, and because the causal mechanism is not yet accepted. Laparoscopic cholecystectomy shows that innovation can become standard before medicine has answered basic comparative questions. It can spread because it is elegant, intuitive, marketable, and desired by patients and clinicians. The new practice can be genuinely useful and still be adopted through a weak evidence process. That combination is important because people often use history selectively. Innovators love Semmelweis. They hear in his story a vindication of the outsider, the data-driven rebel, the clinician who sees what the establishment refuses to see. And that is fair, up to a point. But not every person claiming to be Semmelweis is Semmelweis. Medicine is full of interventions that look promising, make mechanistic sense, generate passionate anecdotes, and later disappoint or harm patients. Guideline defenders, meanwhile, love evidence hierarchies and technology assessment. They hear in the LC case a vindication of caution, comparative effectiveness, randomized trials, cost analysis, and long-term follow-up. And that is also fair, up to a point. But not every deviation from guideline concordant care is reckless. Some deviations are appropriate, patient-centered individualization. Some are necessary because the guideline does not cover the case. Some represent early recognition that the guideline has not caught up to emerging evidence. Some are local safety discoveries. The real problem is classification. When a physician departs from established practice, what kind of departure is it? It could be ignorance. The clinician does not know the standard. It could be error. The clinician knows the standard but misapplies it. It could be adaptation. The standard is broadly right, but this patient's comorbidities, values, contraindications, or context require a different plan. It could be innovation. The standard may be inadequate, and the clinician is trying a new approach with plausible rationale, appropriate consent, and careful monitoring. It could be discovery. The clinician has noticed a recurring pattern that existing medicine has not yet incorporated. It could be fashion. The clinician is swept up in excitement before adequate evidence exists. It could be economic or institutional pressure disguised as innovation. An LLM that judges treatment needs to distinguish among these. A crude guideline matching system will collapse all departures into possible error. A crude novelty-friendly system will collapse all departures into possible insight. Neither is good enough. The Semmelweis and LC cases suggest a better posture. Ask what evidence is available, what evidence is missing, what harms are plausible, what alternatives exist, whether the treatment is reversible, whether patients were informed, whether the rationale is documented, whether the intervention is being monitored, and whether enthusiasm has outrun measurement. For LLMs making treatment recommendations, the safest default is not blind guideline recitation. It is guideline-anchored reasoning with explicit uncertainty and context. Guidelines matter because they encode a great deal of collective evidence, expert consensus, feasibility judgment, and safety experience. They help prevent idiosyncratic care, local mythology, cognitive bias, and overreaction to anecdote. In most ordinary clinical situations, guideline concordant care should have a strong presumption in its favor. But guidelines are not the patient. They are abstractions across populations, evidence reviews, and consensus processes. They lag emerging evidence. They may be silent for complex multimorbidity. They may be based on trials that excluded the patient in front of you. They may contain weak recommendations built on low certainty evidence. They may conflict with patient values or resource constraints. So an LLM should not say only, the guideline recommends X. It should say something more like, for this diagnosis and patient profile, current guidelines generally recommend X. The main reasons are A, B, and C. Important exceptions include D, E, and F. In this patient, the factors that might support deviating are G and H. The evidence strength appears high here, moderate there, and uncertain in this subgroup. That style matters because it preserves both accountability and imagination. The Semmelweis lesson is that an LLM should be able to notice when outcome data or local evidence challenges accepted practice. If a hospital has a cluster of infections linked to a workflow, the AI should not hide behind, "The protocol did not mention this." It should help surface the signal, compare rates, identify plausible mechanisms, and recommend investigation. The LC lesson is that an LLM should resist being dazzled by technical elegance. If a new intervention has impressive early reports but weak comparative evidence, the model should say so plainly. It should distinguish short-term feasibility from safety, safety from effectiveness, and effectiveness from superiority over existing alternatives. It should ask about long-term outcomes, selection bias, learning curves, cost, training, and who benefits. One practical design pattern is to have the LLM present recommendations in layers. Layer 1, what established guidelines or standards recommend. Layer 2, the strength and freshness of the evidence behind those recommendations. Layer 3, patient-specific factors that support or weaken guideline fit. Layer 4, reasonable alternatives and why they might be chosen. Layer 5, areas where innovation, consultation, or trial enrollment may be appropriate. Layer 6, what would need to be monitored if deviating from standard care. That is very different from a model that simply outputs a plan. It also means the model should have humility about scope. An LLM can support clinical reasoning, but it should not pretend that all clinical judgment is reducible to text retrieval. Much of medicine lives in physical examination, procedure skill, local resources, patient trust, longitudinal knowledge, and accountability. The harder problem is using LLMs to judge treatment recommendations that doctors have made. This is tempting. You could imagine feeding a note into an LLM and asking, "Was this guideline concordant? Did the clinician miss a recommended therapy? Did they choose an outdated treatment? Did they fail to document rationale? Did they recommend something unsupported?" That could be useful. It could help catch omissions, reduce variation, support quality review, and provide educational feedback. But it is also risky. The simplest version would grade doctors against guidelines. That might catch genuine errors, but it would also create false positives when the doctor had a good reason to depart. Worse, it could create defensive medicine, where clinicians optimize for machine legibility rather than patient care. The Semmelweis case warns us that the model's established practice may be wrong, incomplete, or behind the evidence. If the doctor is acting on new but credible evidence, or noticing a local safety pattern, the model should not automatically mark that as poor care. The LC case warns us that the model's standard practice may reflect rapid adoption rather than mature evidence. If the doctor resists a fashionable intervention because comparative outcomes are unclear for this patient, the model should not automatically call them old-fashioned. So the first question for an LLM judge should not be, "Did the doctor follow the guideline?" It should be, "What is the relationship between this recommendation, the applicable guideline, the evidence base, and the patient's context?" A useful evaluation might classify a recommendation into categories: guideline concordant and well supported, guideline concordant but poorly documented, guideline discordant with documented patient-specific rationale, guideline discordant without apparent rationale, evidence uncertain, where multiple options are reasonable, innovation or off-label use, requiring explicit consent, monitoring, and ideally protocolized evaluation, potentially unsafe or unsupported. That classification is more humane and more clinically useful than a pass-fail score. Documentation becomes central. If a doctor departs from a guideline, the AI should look for the reason: allergy, contraindication, prior failure, renal function, frailty, goals of care, pregnancy, interactions, patient refusal, limited benefit, local microbiology, pending diagnostic uncertainty, specialist consultation, or enrollment in a trial. If the reason is missing, the model can say, "I cannot tell whether this is thoughtful individualization or an unsupported departure." That is an important distinction. The AI should not infer recklessness from silence too quickly, but it can fairly identify missing rationale as a quality problem. There is also a governance issue. An LLM judging doctors should not be a solitary authority. It should be part of a review process that includes clinicians, specialty standards, local context, and appeal. The model can surface questions, not render verdicts. It can say, "This appears discordant with usual care. Here are possible justifications. Here is what documentation would clarify." In other words, the AI should behave more like a careful peer reviewer than a traffic camera. Here is the framework I would take from these papers for clinical AI. First, separate standards from evidence. A treatment can be standard because evidence is strong, because consensus is strong, because incentives aligned, because alternatives disappeared, or because a practice diffused before anyone slowed it down. An LLM should ask which kind of standard it is. Second, separate novelty from value. A treatment can be new and life-saving, new and useless, new and harmful, or new and promising but unproven. The fact that a practice is innovative does not settle whether it is good. Third, ask whether the mechanism is known. Semmelweis had strong outcome evidence without the full mechanism. LC had a plausible mechanism and intuitive appeal without enough comparative evaluation. Mechanism and outcomes should inform each other, but neither should completely replace the other. Fourth, ask about comparators. Innovation claims often sound strongest when they are compared with a stale version of usual care. The LC paper makes this point beautifully. Some benefits attributed to laparoscopy may have overlapped with broader improvements in postoperative care. The comparator should be the best realistic alternative, not a straw version of the old way. Fifth, ask about the adoption environment. Is the practice spreading because data are compelling, or because patients demand it, surgeons enjoy it, hospitals market it, companies sell it, and journals publish it? Social diffusion is not the same thing as evidence. Sixth, ask about harm and reversibility. Handwashing was low risk and had dramatic apparent benefit. A new surgical technique may have learning curve harms, equipment costs, procedural complications, and downstream effects that require careful assessment. The evidentiary threshold should rise with risk. Seventh, ask whether deviation is being measured. A clinician who departs from standard care with explicit rationale, informed consent, outcome tracking, and willingness to update is in a different category from one who departs casually. Eighth, ask whether the system can learn. Semmelweis's hospital had the data needed to see a mortality difference. The tragedy was partly that medicine did not turn that data into institutional learning. Modern LLMs could help surface patterns, but only if connected to trustworthy data and embedded in a culture that responds well to uncomfortable findings. For treatment recommendation, this framework pushes the LLM to be evidence-aware, patient-specific, and uncertainty-explicit. For treatment judgment, it pushes the LLM to be fair. Detect likely problems, but do not confuse nonconformity with bad care. The two papers leave us with a productive discomfort. Semmelweis reminds us that medicine can be too loyal to established practice. His data showed that handwashing with chlorinated lime was associated with a dramatic fall in maternal mortality, yet acceptance lagged because the claim clashed with theory, identity, and professional culture. The laparoscopic cholecystectomy paper reminds us that medicine can be too loyal to innovation. LC became dominant with extraordinary speed, even though many comparative, economic, long-term, and patient-reported questions were not adequately answered during the adoption window. The lesson for LLMs is not to choose one instinct forever. It is to hold the tension. An LLM recommending treatment should begin with guidelines, but it should not end there. It should explain evidence strength, patient fit, exceptions, alternatives, uncertainty, and monitoring. An LLM judging doctors should flag discordance, but it should also ask whether the discordance is justified, documented, evidence-informed, patient-centered, or part of responsible innovation. The danger is not only that AI will be wrong. The deeper danger is that AI will make one kind of wrongness feel objective. It could freeze medicine into yesterday's consensus, or it could accelerate tomorrow's overconfidence. The better goal is a system that helps medicine do what it has always struggled to do: protect patients from careless deviation without protecting established practice from necessary correction. That is the narrow bridge between guidelines and innovation. It is also the bridge clinical AI will have to learn to walk.